coming. Whenever you're talking about the future, whenever one is talking about the future, obviously to a certain extent, one is casting about. The future hasn't happened yet. So I want to underscore that what I'm doing this evening is engaging in informed conjecture. For that reason, rather than attempt to play Gene Dixon and give you specific predictions, you know, Princess Di will marry Newt Gingrich later on this year or something of that kind, I'm going to attempt to outline the basic features of the way in which I think the world is going to develop and why I think the world is going to develop in that fashion. I will make a few relatively specific predictions, but I want to stress that getting too specific in one's predictions, I think, is asking for trouble. For one thing, it's pretentious as hell, and I try to avoid pretense when I can. I can be pretty hard-nosed about my analysis of what is going on and what has gone on in the past, because the past and the present, at least to a certain extent, are knowable. The future, obviously, has not happened yet, and so to a certain extent, becoming too detailed, I think, is a form of dishonesty, and that's not something that I want to start the new year off by engaging in. I also am going to strive mightily, and this is going to be maybe the most difficult aspect of the talk this evening, I'm going to strive mightily to conclude things in time so that we have a sizable amount of time for questions from the audience, and what might be missing in terms of specifics in the lecture will hopefully be filled in by commentary and or constructive criticism or questions on your part. In part, at least, in hopes of finishing in time to have questions, one of the reasons why I'm not going to get into too much detail about what is going to be happening. I also want to emphasize that past a point, the things that I see as developing, I certainly think they're going to happen, but I would not want to be pinned down as to saying exactly when I think this is going to happen, or precisely when the world that I see coming is going to be in effect. As conjectural as the discussion is going to be this evening, I also want to emphasize that I believe very strongly that as a general consideration, the direction that I see things taking and the direction that I'm going to be outlining for you this evening is definitely where I think things are going. And I think there are already enough firm indications of the direction things are taking that we can, in a sense, extrapolate from the direction things are going in now to where things are going to be going at some point in the future. In future broadcasts on Roy's program, you will be hearing some programs in which I read the information that I'm going to be kicking off the lecture this evening by reading, by way of perhaps presenting a contemporary analytical framework in order to serve as a launching pad or a point of departure for the line of analysis that I'm going to be presenting this evening. I'd like to read a section of one and all of another op-ed column that appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle on successive days in the second week in January of this year. In past broadcasts, I've stated that something that leaves me feeling very ambivalent is the extent to which I'm now reading on the editorial pages and in the op-ed columns of major daily newspapers. I'm reading comments by editorial writers, by guest columnists that sound like they could have been taken straight off of One Step Beyond, either One Step Beyond of 10 years ago or One Step Beyond of 10 weeks ago. On the one hand, that is a positive experience because it is reinforcing of one's own political instincts and affirming of one's own political vision and line of analysis. So that is a positive that engenders a positive reaction. On the other hand, what is going on and what is being presented in these columns and in this commentary is so absolutely, unequivocally awful that I find myself feeling bad about feeling good. And maybe that is about as good a place for analyzing what's going to be happening in the future as one could. It's not so much that you're going to be feeling bad about feeling good, but I think there are going to be massive forces conspiring, and I mean conspiring with a capital C. There is a C word, conspiracy. There will be very powerful forces. Oh, by the way, are we rolling here? Good. There will be very powerful forces that are going to be conspiring mightily in the future to make you feel good about feeling bad. Because I think that the direction that things are going to be taking is going to be extremely unpleasant for the vast majority of people. That majority of people of reversing the situation. Do we have a copy of the flyer for tonight's lecture handy?
Yes.
If you could perhaps, if we could perhaps circulate a couple of these around. The artwork, for those of you who have not seen it, there's a motto here that says, "Don't ever give up." And it shows a large bird, a heron or a crane or something like that, attempting to swallow a frog. That's what's here. And the frog is grabbing the bird around its neck and constricting its throat so it can't swallow it, even as it is in the beak of the bird. I guess you could say it was paying the bill under the circumstances. This, in a sense, is the underlying message. I'm sometimes accused, perhaps not unjustly so, of presenting things in such a way as I defeat people psychologically. I make them feel as though things are hopeless, and they then leave either a broadcast of mine and or a lecture feeling that there's absolutely nothing that they can do. It is a very common response on people's part to say, "Well, gee, Dave, you know, I believe the things you're saying, but I just feel so overwhelmed that I don't think there's anything that I can do." I think that things are indeed moving in a very, very bad direction. I think that there are two elements of hope, or perhaps one element of hope and one element of determination, which hopefully will propel you in the direction of hope. One of the things that I think is a cause for optimism, and I don't think there are many, but that is the tremendous expansion in the ability of an individual to assimilate and process and communicate information. The invention of relatively primitive technological devices such as the radio and the cassette recorder and the talk show and the telephone permit things like talk radio, which, even though it has been used as a vehicle for political reaction in recent years in this country, offers a tremendous opportunity for people to communicate with their fellow citizens. When you call up KABC or KFI or one of these other stations, yeah, granted, the host might be somebody that would have been rejected as a walk-on for the Flintstones. That does not necessarily mean, though, that with a little bit of forethought and with a little bit of determination, you can't use that program to communicate with other people. I know on many of the talk shows in Northern California, the hosts are very quick with the finger on the phone button if you don't agree with them, and most of them fall to the right of Ivan the Terrible. But nonetheless, if you get a few people together and keep hammering away, it sounds very bad for a talk show host to cut off six people in a row. It makes him look like an executioner. That's bad, and he loses. And on the other hand, when you hear six or seven people on a talk show all saying the same thing, that's a very small number of people overall, and yet it sounds like a groundswell. It sounds like a popular movement. In a more sophisticated technological way, things like the computer, advents like the Internet, give people a tremendous ability to communicate with their fellow citizens. And I think, to a large extent, the assimilation and dissemination of the proper information may very well determine the future of the human race. So I think it's incumbent on every one of us never to give up. I think it's incumbent on every one of us to grasp the neck of our would-be consumer. We live in a consumer society. Well, that heroin is consuming that frog, and I think, in a sense, that is the kind of consumer society that we're going to find ourselves living in. And I think it's incumbent on each of us to grab the devour and to use our ability to assimilate and communicate information to prevent getting swallowed, even though it might appear that we're just about to go down the throat of our tormentor. I also think it's important not to kid oneself about just how bad things are and about how bad things are going to be, because things are going to get really, really bad. If you think things are bad now, just bear in mind the old saying that there's nothing like stepping in a cow flop to make you realize how nice tripping over a stone could be and can be. And right now we're tripping over a stone. Well, just wait till you step in a cow flop. These are going to look like the good old days, as bad as they may seem now. That, I think, can be utilized in a strategic sense to motivate oneself to shoulder the task of being a good citizen, to shoulder the task of assimilating information and communicating it in order to educate one's fellow citizens to a sufficient extent to permit viable, broad-based political action. Because all of our survival, I think, spiritually, I suspect, as well as physically, is going to depend on a sufficient number of people becoming sufficiently effective in the arena of political action. So don't ever kid yourself about what the consequences will be if you don't grab that bird's throat. You will get et. Nope, you will be swallowed. And it will not be a whole lot of fun. Again, repeat that pun that I was making, you will pay the bill, so to speak. There were two columns that appeared in January of 1995, just a couple of weeks ago, or actually a little over a week ago, which in many ways, I think, as I said earlier, will serve as a point of departure for tonight's discussion. On Thursday, January 12th of 1995, there was an op-ed column in the San Francisco Chronicle, a very conservative newspaper, by the way, 50% owned by the Hearst Organization. There was an op-ed column by Arthur Miller, the famous playwright and author of, among other plays, Death of the Salesman, that many people are familiar with. Arthur Miller began in a satirical vein, and he entitled this column, "The Best Congress Money Can Buy." What he begins by doing is suggesting that we simply remove the hypocrisy from our contemporary political system by having our congressional representatives employed directly by various corporations. In other words, a representative, rather than representing ostensibly the 12th Congressional District, would simply represent General Motors or a drug company or something of that kind, and that this would actually eliminate hypocrisy, would stimulate interest in our political system, because now the veneer would be taken off and people would be able to appreciate the political process for what it really is. He also goes on to say that the same thing should happen with the Supreme Court. This way the auto industry justice could work out a quid pro quo with the agribusiness justice to throw out cases which might be harmful to the interests of that are backing each of the justices. Then, however, Arthur Miller switches to a much more incisive and serious vein, and I think he delivers a body blow which should not be misunderstood by people reading the column. I think he then goes on to highlight and underscore the nature of his satirical comments by making some comments that I not only agree with, but some comments that I think we all need to understand, and also, not incidentally, comments which agree completely with an analysis that I presented about 5 years previous to the time this column was written. In February of 1990, almost 5 years ago, I did an archive show called Uncle Sam and Il Duce, American Support for Mussolini and the Mythology of the Corporate State, in which I analyzed Mussolini's corporate state. I compared various features, economic and political features of Mussolini's corporate state, and in turn compared Mussolini's corporate state and the economy that was created by it with the economy under Ronald Reagan and George Bush. Then in January of 1995, Arthur Miller penned the following remarks in the San Francisco Chronicle almost 5 years after I did that archive show, which, by the way, is available from Archives on Audio and which has been played on Roy Tuckman's show. Arthur Miller, after speaking in a satirical vein, goes on to say, "Some will object that such a system of what might be called legalized corruption would leave out the public and its interests. But this is no longer a problem when you realize that there is no public and therefore no public interest in the old sense. Possible objections. The abstract justice would disappear under a system that takes only private economic interests into account. Secondly, the corporate state, which this resembles, was Mussolini's concept and resulted in the looting of the public by private interests empowered by the state. Objection to the objections. We already have a corporate state. All privatization would do would be to recognize it as a fact. Conclusion, we are in bad trouble. Amen. I agree with that analysis completely. The whole point, and this is not to blow my own horn, but the whole point of Uncle Sam and Il Duce was that we do indeed have a corporate state, that the political and economic realities that were refined, not invented or brought upon us, but that were refined and fitted, I guess you could say, to the contemporary world by Ronald Reagan, George Bush, and the powers behind them, are identical with the political and economic realities that underlay Mussolini's corporate state. And the corporate state is going to be one of the points of departure in terms of the direction of analysis this evening. Beyond that, the very next day, appropriately enough, Friday, January 13th of 1995, in the very same place, as a matter of fact, on the op-ed page of the San Francisco Chronicle, there was a column by Deborah Saunders of the San Francisco Chronicle, a very conservative political analyst. Usually she serves as a shill for the far right. Here, however, she makes some comments in which she extrapolates not only on the recent flap concerning the Los Angeles chapter of the Mensa newsletter, which came out with some articles advocating eugenics and euthanasia and the building of a master race, very much along the lines of what Hitler advocated in Germany. Then Deborah Saunders goes on to ruminate about American society and its values and comes up with some conclusions that are very similar to the line of speculation that I have been engaging in concerning the drift in the direction of euthanasia and the American euthanasia program or incipient euthanasia program and the history of eugenics, the international mental hygiene, and the international eugenics movements, which I discussed in my last lecture down here in November, and which figure very strongly in the background of such seemingly disparate phenomena as the best-selling book, The Bell Curve, a horrible piece of science, but one which is, I guess you could say, ringing true for a lot of people, despite the fact that it's readily verifiable BS. The eugenics, euthanasia question also looms very large in the background of such phenomena as Proposition 187, which had strong backing from the same sorts of eugenics advocates that had backed Adolf Hitler and that are in a similar direction in the United States. Deborah Saunders ruminated about the comments in the Mensa newsletter, and she entitled her column, Death Instead of Taxes. Of course, there's an old cliche that something is as sure as death and taxes. Here, however, she has corrupted that slightly and has entitled, as I said, her column, Death Instead of Taxes. If we were to take the word taxes in the context that Deborah Saunders is using it in this column, and or to perhaps dolly back, draw the camera back, and assign a larger framework of meaning to the word taxes, instead of referring to taxes in the most narrow literal sense, if we are perhaps to see the term taxes here as representing, quote, wasteful government spending, unquote, the sort of, quote, liberalism, note the quotes, that Newt Gingrich and company are inveighing against, and the sort of, quote, wasteful big government, unquote, that we are now told that Newt Gingrich and company are going to free us from, I think that what we are likely to be seeing in the future is a transition from what is essentially a relatively benign or even a benevolent social system. And granted, this society is rife with injustice, deep centuries-old injustice. But as I said earlier, there's nothing like stepping in a cowflop to make you realize how nice tripping over a stone can be. And when you hear Newt Gingrich North or one of the Tyrannosaurus Rexes of the New Right, now ascendant in the United States, referring to Bill Clinton as a, quote, leftist, unquote, or even a communist, unquote, when you hear the Democratic Party being described as a bunch of, quote, leftists, unquote, I think one should not fail to understand that to the people who are running things and the people who are likely to be structuring our lives in a fundamental way in the future, Bill Clinton is indeed a leftist, and the Democratic Party are indeed, quote, communists, because to a Nazi, a conservative would be seen as a communist. And Bill Clinton is basically a conservative. He's a conservative Southern Democrat. But compared to what's coming, he's going to look like Karl Marx himself, somebody for whom I do not hold a brief. But let's just say, as Ronald Reagan said at the beginning of his second term, you ain't seen nothing yet. He probably doesn't remember saying that right now. You know, see the old... vaudeville line, you know, hey, have you heard Ronald Reagan has Alzheimer's? How can you tell? Ronnie is out of the picture, but though the song is over, the malady will linger on. And I think that what we are going to be seeing in the future, the world to come, will indeed be presenting us with death instead of taxes. In other words, basically, instead of this wasteful big government spending, you know, the welfare state, and all the sort of hoo-ha that we're hearing from Gingrich and company, flat out, people are going to be eliminated. And those who aren't eliminated are going to be made to think that 2 plus 2 equals 5, one way or another. So death instead of taxes could have, in a sense, been the title of the lecture this evening, because that is how they're going to balance the budget, folks. They're not going to provide social services. They're going to get rid of people that quite either won't do without or clamor too large, too loudly for the social services which they either never received or used to receive but won't be receiving anymore. Nope, they're going to get death instead of taxes. Reading from the San Francisco Chronicle of Friday, January 13th of 1995. Quote, "We better face the fact that we have to kill people," Kern County Attorney Jason G. Brent told the Los Angeles Times. "There are not unlimited amounts of resources," unquote. Brent was defending a controversial article he had written for the monthly newsletter of the Los Angeles chapter of Mensa, the High IQ Society. In it, Brent wrote, quote, "Society must face the concept that we kill off the old, weak, the stupid, and the inefficient." Well, if they kill off the stupid and the inefficient, that's going to be the end of not only the Republican Party, but most of the Washington political establishment. So don't hold your breath about that happening. But I think that the comments here by Jason Brent should not be seen as the rantings and ravings of some pretentious super-intellectual twit. Let me read more. Another Mensa contributor, John Evans, wrote that many homeless, quote, should be humanely done away with, like abandoned kittens, unquote. And again, quoting, a piece of meat in the shape of a man but without a mind is not a human being, whether the body be deathly ill, damaged by accident, mentally blank because of brain deficiency, read in here the bell curve, read in here, quote, niggers, unquote, or any of the, quote, special interests, unquote, that are perceived as ruining the United States. And as I've said in past lectures and broadcasts, forgive my use of strong language, but one should never mistake how the people in power in this country are thinking, and that's exactly how they are thinking. Continuing, a piece of meat in the shape of a man, but without a mind, is not a human being. Whether the body be deathly ill, damaged by accident, mentally blank because of brain deficiency, or criminally insane, unquote. The reaction in and outside of Mensa has been one of shock and horror. Likening the infirm to blobs of meat is ominously reminiscent of the Nazi term useless eaters, unquote, which justified Nazi extermination of the sick. Want to know what the future of health care is going to be? It's going to be death instead of taxes. Continuing, some of you may be tempted to dismiss this story as an anomaly, the stuff of twit geniuses so intoxicated with their IQs that they've turned stupid. Yet the belief that it is better for others to die than be a burden is becoming increasingly common, right down to the part about kittens. January's American Spectator magazine features a commentary which first appeared in the Amherst Bulletin written by the Reverend Donna Schaefer of the United Church of Christ. Schaefer wrote of how her cat killed off her own litter, then noted, quote, "While not arguing for infanticide, I have to argue at least the plausibility of withdrawing maternal care." Interrupting, I think that behind these remarks one can perhaps see the future of Newt Gingrich's Boys Town social agenda, where Newt Gingrich is talking about separating welfare mothers from their children and putting the children in institutions. The Nazi extermination programs under Tiergartenstrasse 4 involved the elaborate use of front organizations that were set up to care for these poor unfortunates who basically were enveloped in the Third Reich's bureaucracy. The T4, Tiergartenstrasse 4 program, was named after Tiergartenstrasse 4, the address of the German ministry under which the Nazi euthanasia program was begun. That led directly to the Third Reich's extermination programs. But people inquiring about their relatives, who by the time of the inquiry had already been dispatched, were simply shunted back and forth in the bureaucracy and told in this manner, through deliberate bureaucratic obfuscation, the actual physical extermination of human beings was hidden. And one should never mistake the possible gravity of the thrust of comments like Newt Gingrich's, where saying, well, after two or policies like that, well, after 2 years, if the mother doesn't have a job, we'll take away her children. What are they going to do with the kids next? Well, stick around. Quote, "While not arguing for infanticide, I have to argue at least the plausibility of withdrawing maternal care. Pushing your children into a lake is hardly that. But Susan Smith, the South Carolina mom who killed her two sons by strapping them into her car and letting it roll into a lake, quote, was making an announcement. She couldn't care for her children. Instead of making their lives permanently miserable, she drowned them. There is a strange, cruel mercy in the act," unquote. This, by the way, is from a Unitarian minister. Continuing, "Last month, an elderly Florida couple worth $10 million was found dead in their Cadillac Eldorado. Richard Brown, 79, had suffered from arthritis and asthma. Helen Brown, 76, had Alzheimer's disease. In a note sent to their friends before their suicide, the Browns explained that they were killing themselves in part because the cost of their health care would, quote, consume a substantial amount of their money, of our money, unquote, which they donated to the United Church of Christ missions in order to, quote, help many young people throughout the world and who one day may be able to help many more, unquote. Rather than sadly renouncing this suicide as a tragic waste, their former pastor, Charles Heuser, H-E-U-S-E-R, told the Associated Press that the Browns, quote, were taking the high road to death, unquote. Heuser, by the way, said he was the guy who persuaded the Browns to leave their money to the church. Oh. Okay, then what is the United Church of Christ? Educate me about the Protestant denomination. Oh, I thought that was the Unitarians.
No, okay.
I stand corrected. Totally different. Well, all righty. My agnosticism is showing its underpinnings here, I suppose. That's what I thought, but then again, I've thought the same thing about a number of institutions, which turned out to be not nearly as progressive as I had thought. Continuing. In November, Oregon voters approved Measure 16, a physician-assisted suicide initiative. Before the election, the opposition campaign asked likely voters this question. If you knew that as a result of the pressure to contain health care costs, a doctor might encourage a terminally ill patient to choose physician-assisted suicide over more expensive treatment, would you favor or oppose, unquote? 36% said they would favor. Blame it on the deficit, high taxes, or a rotting culture, or D, this says Dave Emery, all of the above. But a growing number of Americans view others as a liability they would just as soon terminate. Assisted suicide advocates seem to believe that this country is so moral that there is no reason to fear the misuse of assisted suicide. But when a minister defends maternal abandonment as being, quote, as regular people say, for the best, quote, while another lauds a couple's suicide, where is compassion for the young or the aged? When more than a third of voters would rather save money than heal the sick, Don't bet on America's reverence for life. I think there is much food for thought in that particular column, as there was in Arthur Miller's column the previous day. I would also note, perhaps it's irrelevant, but I think we should take note of this, because this lecture again was entitled "The Future: Technology, Theocracy, and the Thousand-Year Reich." Note that the editorial comment being scored by Deborah Saunders in that column was being offered up by two people of the cloth, one male, one female. Two ministers were endorsing this merciful act, i.e., murder and suicide, which, under traditional religious values, those are not values that are seen as being merciful and humanitarian. I think that the thrust of those two columns, on the one hand, the fact that we already have a corporate state, Santa Clara Valley, the much ballyhooed Silicon Valley, which is where I live and work, there is a very large population of born-again Christians, and this is not in any way to belittle any individual or their religion. I'm going to extrapolate from reactionary Christianity in just a minute, and extrapolate from that even more later in the discussion. But there are a lot of born-again Christians in the Santa Clara Valley, which also, not incidentally, is the epicenter of the defense electronics industry. That is an area that was so strategically sensitive in the 1980s that no Soviet citizen was allowed within a 40-mile radius by our intelligence services. My nickname for it was not the Silicon Valley, but the Valley of the Shadow of Death, because the defense industry was basically what the Santa Clara Valley was all about. In the early 80s, I had a second job in addition to my regular day job, working part-time at a retail outlet. And there was a woman who used to come in frequently with her family and her kids to buy this, that, and the other thing. And she worked at Lockheed Missiles and Space in Sunnyvale, which manufactured, among other things, the internet, the ICBMs for the Trident submarine. And she used to come in. She was a serious born-again Christian and was always handing out prayer cards and quoting scripture and trying to convert me or anybody else who would listen. And most often, not always, but most often, she would, at least during the cooler weather, she would wear a Trident windbreaker. In other words, on the back, it would say Trident in big, bold, yellowish-orange letters, and it was a blue windbreaker. And here she was. It was a very grotesque spectacle to me. Here she was talking about the Prince of Peace and espousing world Christian fellowship, while she was advertising on the back the product of her employer, which was a device which would destroy, if ever used, would destroy all human life on this earth. I've forgotten how many cities each Trident submarine could destroy, but one Trident submarine, I think, could destroy every major city in the Soviet Union. Those were some awesome weapons that those things were sporting and are sporting. And when one considers that one of the commandments, or one of the edicts that the Christians are supposedly adhering to, is "what God hath wrought, let no man tear asunder." And here are these people busily earning their livings, building machines that would tear everything God, quote, wrought, unquote, asunder. And I asked her about the conflict, or what I obviously saw as a conflict, between worshiping the Prince of Peace and yet advertising the gods of war on one's across one's back. And she saw no conflict whatsoever. She said, "Well, these are the last days, you know, so it really isn't going to matter. If there's a nuclear war, it really won't matter because, you know, Jesus is coming back." That is how you get people to sit on the tack, folks, is you convince them that there is a higher meaning to sitting on that tack. And if they sit on that tack long enough, then they'll become saints. We are also seeing something, by the way, as has been the case frequently in past lectures, we're honored this evening by the presence of a very fine human being and a very stalwart political crusader, someone that I think is perhaps in a position to appreciate some of what I'm saying better than most, namely Farah Mansour, a very heroic member of the Iranian resistance who has done landmark work on the Islamic fundamentalist movement, primarily in Iran but also elsewhere, And Farah's research has pointed out, and I think made the case inarguably, that despite the appearances to the contrary, the United States and Britain, as well as to a lesser extent Germany, have actually backed the fundamentalist Muslims who are in power in Iran and elsewhere, and that reactionary fundamentalist Islam, like reactionary fundamentalist Christianity, has received the good blessings and the active, tactical, and strategic support of the very same national security and corporatist elements in this country that really lie at the core of the corporate state that I'm talking about. And the conditions under which people live in areas where the Islamic fundamentalists have achieved power, well, those conditions are horrible. And it is my opinion, by the way, during the question and answer session, Farah can he can elaborate on this or disagree with me if he does, but I think that in areas of the Third World, I think Islam is being envisioned as a force similar to reactionary Christianity. Convince the peasantry that wretchedness is a blessing and that their real reward will lie in the next lifetime. You can get them to acquiesce and basically spend a whole lifetime sitting on that tack, or perhaps even prostrating themselves on that tack in the direction of Mecca five times a day. Beyond that, I think there is an indication that yet another form of religion may very well be utilized to help get us sit on that tack. By the way, I want to stress that I'm not dumping on anyone's individual religious preferences. I take every individual and every individual's religious views as they come. So when I talk about the New Age, it's a very broad term and it applies to a lot of different things. I don't want people to take this personally, but I have a fair amount of experience with New Age culture, which oddly enough is very prevalent in the Santa Clara Valley, just as is born-again Christianity. One of the radio stations I work at in the Bay Area in particular has a very large New Age contingent and plays a lot of New Age music and has a lot of New Age talk shows. And the New Age itself, it's a very broad term. One could perhaps, in fact, some people would see things as relatively conventional as yoga or acupuncture as being, quote, New Age, unquote. I'm rather talking about some religious and, quote, spiritual, unquote, orientations, which I think are at best questionable and which I think beyond that represent something of an antechamber, some of them anyway, to fascism. We should not lose sight of the fact that Nazism itself had a very strong degree of overlap with the occult. In fact, the inner core of the Nazi Party per se evolved from a pan-German occult society called the Thule Society, and that at the inner core of the SS philosophy was an explicit occult, an anti-Semitic, pan-German occultism. There are strong elements of the occult which are explicitly fascistic or, at the very best, pro-fascistic. I have seen a degree of overlap, and in fact, Arianna Huffington embodies that overlap between a New Age religion and outright fascism, and indeed, Ms. Huffington, whom I'm making a point of addressing very politely if this lecture should ever be played on the air. Ms. Huffington is a very interesting individual. I would note that the same reactionary Christians who should be totally rejecting someone of who's been following John Roger were very comfortable that she, in fact, was a sister in Christ. I think there is a fair amount of overlap between some elements of the New Age religious and philosophical movement and things which could be at best described as proto-fascistic. Beyond that, I've seen in my own experiences with some New Age philosophy not only a proto-fascist orientation, but a dangerously unrealistic orientation, which I think, again, is something that would incline a human being towards remaining seated on that sharp tack and convincing themselves that, in fact, it was very, quote, spiritual, unquote, to sit on that tack and to deny oneself, perhaps. There was a talk show on the same radio station in Northern California that I work on, and they were having some charlatan, frankly, on there, and it was a New Age call-in talk show, and they were kicking around a bunch of BS, and one caller, to his credit, called up the host and this jerk that he had as a guest. And what they were, the basic thrust of the discussion was that we're headed for a golden age. And in the next century, we're all going to live in a golden age and everything is going to be wonderful. By the way, strong elements of fascism, an Italian Nazi philosopher named Julius Ebola specifically saw the end result of fascism as a, quote, golden age, unquote, in which human existence would be so purified that people wouldn't even have to think. They could just wish things true. This is very similar to some elements, I say some elements, of New Age philosophy and New Age religion. Anyway, the thrust of this show is that we're all headed to a golden age and that everything is going to be just wonderful. And a guy called up and said, what do you mean we're headed for a golden age? Things are horrible. He said, look at all the horrible things around us. How about the destruction of the ozone layer? How do you see that as consistent with a golden age and increased spirituality on the earth? No problem, said the guest. He said that, actually, we shouldn't not only shouldn't worry about the destruction of the ozone layer, but actually it was a very good thing because purple was a very, very spiritual color. And that as the ozone layer disintegrated, it would increase the amount of ultraviolet radiation on the earth, and this in turn would increase the spirituality on the earth. Scouts Honor, this is what this hockey puck was saying on his show. And I'll say this, that this individual was right about one thing. If the ozone layer goes and we have no protection from the ultraviolet radiation, we're all going to be spirits. So that will increase the amount of spirituality on the earth. But going back to the thrust of the discussion, I think this unfortunate individual, and I wish I could say that a fair number of that type of individual around, that is an individual who not only has been convinced to keep sitting on the tack, he's bloody well going to spend his time convincing other people to sit on the tack as well. And I think that the New Age, some aspects of New Age religion clearly anticipate a pro-fascist, pro-corporatist, theocratic approach. Basically, if you are not drawn to reactionary Christianity or, say, reactionary Islam, you can be convinced by Guru Bhagwan Sri Panzerfuhrer to join the Holy Order of the Purple Beyond. And that is how they will convince you to sit on the tack. And Guru Panzerfuhrer will tell you, oh, no, do not worry. Do not worry at all. I know that it feels very bad sitting on the tack at first, but Krishna, in all of his wisdom, has developed many, many different kinds of pleasure on this earth. And this particular kind of pleasure that you're experiencing right now is a type of pleasure that we call pain, you see. So as we abide spiritually, do not worry about this particular form of pleasure called pain, because Krishna has intended you to learn to love pain, and that way when you experience the higher forms of pleasure, the higher forms of pleasure beyond pain, then you will become even more highly evolved. And this is how you will make it to the 12th level of purple existence. Assuming that you meet the $500 fee, which I will collect from you at the intermission from my lecture. Thank you very much. And if that doesn't work, thank you. Does somebody want to collect my $500 fee, by the way? If that doesn't work, then I'll have Pastor Karl-Heinz Luftwaffe convince you that suffering is a blessing and we should all place our faith in Jesus, because sooner or later, we all are going to have to shuffle off this mortal coil, so let us not pay too much attention to our travails on this veil of tears. Yes, I know that life is hard, life is painful, but it has been ordained for us to experience the reality of Jesus on the cross. Though the passion that he must have felt as they drove those nails into his skin. We think we have suffering. All you have to do is sit on a little tack. Think about what our Lord, when our God gave up his only son, he had huge nails driven through his hands and a crown of thorns placed upon his head and a spear thrust into his side. And all we have to do is to sit on a small tack. Yes, we are blessed children. So let us pray. And while we are praying, I will pass around the collection plate. And please put your hard-earned wages into the collection plate so that we can all become tacky together. Okay? I'll tell you, I'm myself an agnostic. I can see certain aspects. I can see certain aspects of higher mathematics and physics that could indicate that there might be something beyond what is immediately evident. I don't worry about it because we all get there sooner or later, some of us perhaps sooner than others. But I had the occasion to go to, I don't want to offend any individual's religious beliefs. I had the occasion to go to a former roommate's funeral late last year, and he basically placed all of his faith in vodka. That's basically what he believed in, which is going to get us to something else as we talk about mind control and the use of drugs and inebriants to get you to set on the tack. Because if you don't get hoodwinked by Guru Bhagwan Sri Panzerfuhrer, or if you don't get inculcated by Pastor Karlheinz Luftwaffe, then basically, you know, Brother Love on the corner is going to sell you a joint, a packet of heroin, you know, a speedball or something like that, or else maybe just a gallon of, moonshine or whatever, and you just wipe yourself out, and you won't even feel the tack. So you'll stay seated on it because you're nodding out. But Jim was, shall we say, irreverent, he was irreverent about everything except vodka, and that was ultimately what killed him. It was kind of a sad situation. But at his funeral, first of all, his sister was an absolute nutcase born-again Christian, and she delivered this interminable eulogy over her brother, talking about, oh, how wonderful it was, because now Jim was with Jesus. If Jim had been there, he would have puked. He never would have liked this, although he hated his sister, and the last thing he cared about was Jesus. But she went on and on. But it was a Catholic mass, and it's been a long time since I had seen the Catholic communion, and the priest went on and on, droning on and on in this monotone about how this becomes the blood of Jesus, and this becomes his body, and our brother Jim shall be sanctified. It goes on. It's basically this act of totem cannibalism that was really quite horrifying. And ever the cynic, frankly, was having a hard time suppressing giggles in the very back row. I was hoping that people thought I was crying and that I was actually trying to cover up laughter. But finally, at the end, the guy concluded the communion by saying, "And we take it, and we eat it." And I dissolved. I just dissolved. I said, "You got that right, pal. You know, you got at least that much right." And I ran out the back of the church and I roared like a big dog out in the parking lot for about 5 minutes. You know, you take it and you eat it. That is what is going to be happening under this fascist-oriented, technologically-based theocracy. You're going to take it, and you're going to eat it. And you're going to like it, too. And the fact that you will be sitting on the tack while you are chewing will really be the point. Because, again, this conflict between the needs of the corporate state and the needs of the individual and the planet itself are in a state of fundamental conflict. I think the dominant power element of the world today is the transnational corporation. I think even the nation state itself is in a state of obsolescence. And one of the things that I think is going to be happening is that larger countries are going to be balkanized, that ethnicity is going to be deliberately heightened so that peoples first of all, they quarrel with each other and blame each other for the problems which in fact will be created by the corporate state. Here we're seeing people of color, for example, poor people and minorities being scapegoated for America's economic problems, hence the code word that really lies behind the call to reduce government spending. They're not talking about holding down government spending. It basically is a racist battle cry. It means let's get those niggers and Mexicans who are spending our hard-earned tax dollars on their welfare. That is not what's caused America's problems, not poor people, not people of color, but rather the corporate state. But people are going to be, since people are going to have to be convinced to sit on the tack, they will also be convinced that, in fact, the pain is not coming from that tack, which is stuck in their rear end, but it's coming from the person in the seat behind them who is stabbing them. And so that if they want to cure their problems, they can turn around and stab the person in the seat behind them, and then they won't feel that pain. That's another way in which people are going to have to be, they are already being convinced to sit on the tack. I think that ethnicity will also be used to break up larger nation states to create less powerful and potentially less effective entities. Because the smaller a country is, the less powerful it is, and the less capable it will be of resisting some of these huge transnational corporations. I think that's another pattern that we will be seeing in the future. I think that technology itself will be utilized in combination with religion and totalitarianism to produce a number of effects that I'm going to be talking about in the second part of the discussion this evening. So one more thing I want to touch on, and I've already touched on it in the discussion, that is another thing that is going to be used to convince people to sit on the tack, something that will be used to get them to adjust the conflict between the reality principle and the pleasure principle in such a way as to suit the needs of the corporate state. Remember, if you're sitting on a tack, the pleasure principle is going to drive you to get up off the tack because it hurts. Now, you can do that in a couple of ways. You can resolve that pain either by getting up off the tack or by somehow altering your internal environment in such a way as the pain no longer is perceptible to you. I've already cited some of the ways that can be done. Or in the case of intimidation, even though the pain may be perceptible, you will be convinced that you could experience a worse pain, so don't worry about that. Another way, of course, is to get people to literally submit themselves to narcosis. There is substantive evidence, overwhelming evidence, in fact, that to a considerable extent the, quote, drug problem, unquote, in this country and in other countries is being, if not deliberately created, at least actively aided and abetted by elements of the intelligence services and the national security establishment, which also are being employed in a law enforcement capacity to help to combat that very drug problem. There is substantive evidence that cocaine, heroin, and other forms of inebriants are being deliberately introduced into elements, into areas of American society, in particular inner-city neighborhoods and neighborhoods inhabited by people of color, not only in order to help fund corporations in the foreign policy sphere, but also to basically keep the people in those neighborhoods and in those mini-societies, so to speak, in a state of narcosis, to keep them drugged up, literally morphined out in such a way as they can endure that pain. Again, if you've been swilling vodka like my late ex-roommate, or if you've been shooting heroin or snorting cocaine or whatever, that's another way to get people to sit on the tack. Basically, when you're knotted over like this, you're not worried about the pain that you would be experienced by sitting on that tack because you're no longer conscious of the pain. Your central nervous system has been so chemically altered that you're no longer experiencing the receptors, the pain signals from your central nervous system. And that's another way to get people to sit on the tack, is to drug them out. One of the very first things that the Nazis would do, for example, upon occupying a country, is to drastically increase the price of food, but to hold the price of liquor roughly stable, so that it actually became a cheaper way for people who were poor to gain their calories by drinking beer or some other, rather than by going out and buying bread. So that way they at least were able to sustain themselves in a certain minimal sense by putting enough calories into themselves to keep going, at the same time as they were much less inclined to political activism and organization and resistance, because they were teetering down the street after drinking their dinner instead of eating it. By the way, what time is it now? 8:30. Would people like to take a break now? Because we're definitely going to have time. How many for a break now? Well, I think it's probably just over half. Why don't we take a short break now, and then I'll finish the second half of the lecture. We'll then have a short break before a question and answer session. But remember what we've heard so far, because so far they've been quite adept at getting people to sit on the tack. What we're going to talk about in the second part of the lecture is how, as the world turns, so to speak, how they're going to get people to sit on the tack when the tack becomes longer and sharper and more painful, because that's what it's going to do. Take a break, maybe 10 minutes or so, and then we'll continue with the discussion. Yep. Yes.
React and corporate. Thank you.